It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. Joining me in studio, of the Film Yap fame, of the best-dressed member of the IFJA fame, and somebody whose kids took my spot in the critics' depth chart. I'm not bitter, hell no. But it's Christopher Lloyd. Hi, Chris.
Hey, it is great to be here, as always.
I can still throw the ball farther than your kid, and I'm a better critic than Tim Tebow. So there. I joke because his son made his television debut, criticism debut last week.
No, believe it or not, that was actually his third time
his
on the show.
Third? See, I'm so behind. I'm still studying the playbook.
This was the first time, though, that other times he was sitting on my lap and talking. This was the first time he got his own chair and his own mic.
He demanded it.
No. But I'll tell you what, when the production person came out and mic'd him up, I thought his eyes were going to explode. That was just like,
oh, no, he's doomed.
Yes.
What were his other reviews before Paddington 2?
I'm trying to remember. It's been a while now. So the last one was before he started first grade, because it used to be like, you know, he was free on Fridays. So it would have been like last summer. So what was the big kids movie last summer? I don't remember.
Not Lars von Trier.
The first one was completely unplanned. It was, I can't remember what it was, but I had to have him with me that day.
Sure.
And he was like standing off camera, and he kept inching closer and closer and closer. And like literally 5 seconds before we went on air, like they were doing the countdown, Amber Hankins just pointed to him and said, "Do you want to come on?" And he was like, "Uh-huh." And he just jumped on my lap.
Straight out of 42nd Street.
Yes. If you actually go back and look at that clip on the Wish TV website, you can see like the first second is like, it seems like we're bobbling around. It's because he had just jumped on my lap and we were getting subtle. But yeah.
He didn't hit you in the nether regions.
Yeah. And actually, his teacher played the segment in his class yesterday.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah, if he's not already getting a swelled head about it, I'm sure he is now.
Well, I'm going to have a talk with this lad. But anyway, we'll get to that in a little bit. But there's quite a bit, because we have Oscar contenders that are still trickling in, and we have films that, well, they got to fill the multiplexes. So
yeah.
I guess we'll start with you got to see 12 Strong. It seems like at least two or three times a year we get the inspirational military police fire thing, and this is not directed
true story.
It's not directed by Peter Berg this time, and it doesn't have Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, probably the one about the firefighters from just a few months ago is probably like the most recent one of that ilk.
Yes.
And these movies kind of, you know, are all, you kind of know what you're going to get. You've got like the one big star in it, then you've got the one person who's not quite as big a star, and then you have maybe like one or two other recognizable character actors, and then you have a bunch of people that you've never seen or heard of, could place their face anywhere. And it's always, you know, men coming together in wartime. And it's, you know, Chris Hemsworth is the star, and Michael Shannon plays the grizzled older guy, even though they're only like 7 years apart in age.
That's really okay. Does he have all his fingers in this one?
He does. Okay. He does. It was okay. You know, I put in that pretty good category. Like, I'd recommend it if you're into that sort of thing. Wouldn't necessarily say this is the greatest thing ever. It's not bad. Kind of disappointed with, you know, the Michael Shannon role as it was written. It was like the first movie I've ever seen Michael Shannon in where I could point to and say, pretty much any other actor could do that.
Ooh.
Which, you know, usually the great thing about any Michael Shannon movie is he's so distinct and original and, you know, him.
Right.
Whereas the first one I was like, yeah, I mean, I could, you know, off the top of my head, you know, name half a dozen other actors that you could swap out and the movie would pretty much be unchanged. It's the true story, true-ish, you know, we don't know.
Every other film is based on a true story.
Yeah, of what has now come to be known as the Horse Soldiers, which is these were Army Special Forces soldiers and also a few CIA guys and such who were literally the first person in country in Afghanistan after 9/11 taking the fight to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and the more or less true story about them, which was, you know, officially their job was to just go in, partner up with an Afghani warlord and call in airstrikes while they did all the work. And of course it didn't work out that way. They ended up being in firefights, and people may remember that, you know, some of their activities were being reported on right after they were happening. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, actually gave a speech where he described what was going on. And it was true. It was, you know, literally you had our soldiers and Afghani soldiers, you know, on horseback fighting against tanks and mortars and artillery.
And while he was doing this, Errol Morris was filming it with Philip Glass music playing under it.
Yeah. So I said, if this was a Western, which anyway, it kind
there
of
is a
bit
Western.
Is.
Well, yeah, but it's not John Wayne and William Holden, nor is it directed by John Ford.
Yeah, but it's what you would call an auteur, you know, a good old fashioned war auteur.
Uh-huh.
I kind of wish they would fleshed out. You know, we get the home life of basically two and a half of the characters. Michael Pena is kind of the third wheel in this. But other than that, you know, the second half kind of devolves in just a whole bunch of firefights and things like that. And, you know, a little long, a little repetitive. The movie's 2 hours, 10 minutes long. Could easily have been about 15 minutes shorter, I think.
Mm-hmm. Also, you can read the review of this on the Film Yap, of course, where you can also see a review of Den of Thieves, the new. All right, let me ask you, Chris Lloyd, what was the last Gerard Butler film you actually saw in the theater?
I think I've seen all of them.
Really?
Or at least the
Why?
Ones most recently.
Geostorm?
Well, it was like, you know, like the Olympus Falls.
Olympus has Fallen. I'm trying to go back because, I mean, here at Film Sociology, the thriving metropolis of Film Sociology, I will look at like, okay, I have a choice between the latest Gerard Butler film and something else. And quite often, I've been leaning towards something else.
Yeah.
Because here's what we have besides Den of Thieves. Hunter Killer, which I have no clue about. Geostorm.
Yeah, that was just came out not too long ago.
Yep. A Family Man, didn't see. London Has Fallen.
Yeah, that was the sequel to Olympus Has Fallen.
Yeah. Gods of Egypt.
Yeah, that was pretty awful.
Okay, I'm not going to count How to Train Your Dragon 2 because it's vocal work. It's fine. That's not a dismissal. Olympus Has Fallen, that's 2013. Movie 43, I didn't see it in the theater, but I rented it, and that was my worst film of 2013. Playing for Keeps.
Yeah.
Didn't see that. Chasing Mavericks, I rented, only because it was, if I remember right, and I might have flip-flop these, and I'm sorry, but it Michael Apted was directing it. No, Curtis Hanson directed it and got sick, so Michael Apted took over or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, they got dual credits on that. Machine Gun Preacher.
Yeah.
Coriolanus. I actually saw Coriolanus. That was the last one. But that's 2011.
Yeah.
So.
Well, but this way, you know, he's stayed busy for the last 15 years, really since 300 was his big breakout movie.
Right.
And I think it became clear soon after that he wasn't going to be the next A-list action star or whatever. But, you know, and yet, you know, he could have kind of gone one of two ways. He could have said, I'm going to go and be the star of, you know, second tier and third tier movies, so always be busy and always be making these movies, but you know, I'm not going to get $20 million paydays, and I'm not going to be, you know, red carpet guy and, you know, cover magazines, things like that. Or I can go and, you know, be like the supporting character in those big stars movies and, you know, help out other people. And he went the first way, which you know, a lot of people have gone that way. And, you know, 15 years later, I mean, he's still working.
Still at it, yeah.
And you know, those Olympus movies, you know, the first one I think was actually pretty decent, if I recall. The second one, not so much. But, you know, those made a lot of money internationally.
I know what I would say. I think also he's kind of like the 21st century Sly or Schwarzenegger, that if nobody's seeing it here in the States, somebody overseas is.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's probably like, you know, where like Jean-Claude Van Damme was 15 years ago as a star, you know, always bankable, not top tier or maybe even second tier, but working.
Well, there's something to be said about that. So.
Yeah, so I didn't see this because, unfortunately, they screen Den of Thieves the same night as they did 12 Strong, and I had to choose. So. But we do have one of our newer film yappers, Logan Sowash, who has a review up of Den of Thieves, so go check that out. That is the quintessential bank robbery movie, which is we've got the best crew of bank robbers in the world.
Wait. How can it be if Curtis 50 Cent Jackson is there?
Yeah, I've always seen that, you know, with like Inside Man with Denzel Washington, you know, the best in the world.
Do they have tournaments to decide?
I don't know. But then the flip side is they're going up against the best in the world in the Los Angeles Police Special Unit Crime Prevention. So
Al Pacino.
We get the best of the best. And so I think Gerard Butler plays the good guys, and that actor from Orange is the New Black, Pablo, I can't remember his last name.
Okay.
I think he heads up the crew of the bad guys. I can't remember if 50 Cent is in it, and I can't remember if he's amongst the good guys or the bad guys.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
So, you know, you kind of got a little bit of like, this is sort of like a poor man's Heat, you know, the Michael Mann movie, obviously, with Pacino and De Niro.
Michael Mann, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, this is sort of a poor man's version of that. Logan Sowash says that it's got great gunplay, but they don't really flesh out the characters too much. So he's kind of giving a middling to maybe middling down kind of review.
The writer, director, and producer of Den of Thieves is also the man who gave us the screenplay for London Has Fallen and A Man Apart. So there's that.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, opening in theaters that we both saw, and, well, not together, but, and this is one, it's kind of, it was bantered about a little bit as far as award consideration, and it's probably kind of dipped down a little bit.
Yeah,
but
it was like, call me by your name. Like late November, a movie a lot of critics, entertainment journalists were talking about, and hasn't really made any kind of headway in the award season. It's kind of, you know, it's a smaller film. I think mostly what it's going to happen and what's been talked about is it's the breakout role for a young actor by the name of Timothée Chalamet.
Who I think we gave the runner-up to at the IFJA. He's known as
Breakout of the Year.
And he was the brooding kid in Lady Bird.
Yes, and he was quite good in that.
Very good in that.
And here he has this lead role, and it's set in the 1980s in Italy. Is it Italy or Greece?
No, it's Italy.
It's Italy.
Northern Italy, if I remember
And Michael
right.
Stuhlbarg plays this professor, and he is the son of that professor. He's supposed to be like, they never explicitly say I get it to be like 16, maybe 17 years old.
Young enough or old enough, depending on the film, yeah.
Yeah, and they have a practice where every summer they take in a graduate student, you know, someone who's basically going on to become a professor like the dad, and spends the summer doing research or whatever, and Armie Hammer plays that guy.
And ladies, and a few dudes, don't you wish all grad students look like Armie Hammer?
Yeah, and again, it's a little unclear how old that character is supposed to be, you know, at least 25, maybe not quite 30. It's funny because I have different descriptions of the movie. I've heard it like anywhere from he's 31 and he's 15 to he's 17 and he's 23, depending on
when it comes to love in Italy in the summer, numbers have no matter whatsoever.
Yes, but so, you know, they start to, you know, have longing glances, which eventually turns into a
fairly
brief but intense affair, and then heartbreak when inevitably, you know, this summer ends and things go on like that. I don't know. I'm further down on this movie than I think most of our fellow critics in the Indiana area are. I liked it. I think this last 45 minutes or so packs a real emotional punch, and is splendidly acted. I think the first hour of the movie is really hour to hour and 15 is borderline interminable.
Wow.
To the point where, like, literally that first 75 minutes should have been about 20.
Well, okay. Just a note. It's also, the screenplay was done by James Ivory, for you Merchant Ivory fans out there, and it's directed by, and I'm going to butcher this, I'm sorry, Lucia Guadagnino, who gave us two films I really liked, I Am Love and A Bigger Splash. And what I didn't mind the length on this one as well, because when you set something in Northern Italy in the early, it's like they're on different time. It's like you're in Provence or Stealing Beauty or anything. It's just they don't run on American time.
Is it EPT, European People Time?
Kinda. I mean, seriously. So that pacing of it did not bother me as much.
Yeah.
I understand where you could, and I'm sure critics always tell you how much, and I do it too. Well, if you'd slide such and such minutes off of this, and I probably still would have liked it, but I didn't mind the build up because we have a young lad who's got ideas, and then a girl shows up, and he's kind of bouncing back and forth. And so anyway, I didn't mind the little relationship chess match that was going on all summer.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, sort of duality between these two of, I mean, there's a point there where they actually seem like antagonists.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both sort of, they're both sort of denying the attraction between them. I think, it's set in the 80s, so I think the dynamics are a little different. If it was 2018, is like, no one really wants to be out or open about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people talking about that at the end of the movie, the Michael Stuhlbarg character gives this speech to his son, which is nice, but I don't know. For me, it didn't feel like they had invested in that character, the father character, to give us that speech. It was just sort of like, he's this doddering figure off in the background, making comments, doesn't seem to be really involved in anybody's lives very deeply, and then boom, all of a sudden he's got, these tremendous insights into the depths of his kid's soul. It just kind of came, like, they really, it seems like that first hour of the movie, they spent too much of it just focusing on those two guys, not really doing much for me. I mean,
okay,
to me, if it actually built, but for me, it just felt like it was going sideways. I would have liked to have seen more of the mother, more of the father, more of the internal life of that girl that he's briefly dallying with.
Right.
Spread it around. Make it about these characters rather than just these two.
I can agree with you on that. I would say if you're Michael Stuhlbarg, if you don't get that monologue, you're not doing the film.
Oh yeah,
totally. And you've seen these roles. You have a really good that person playing mom or dad, and as you said, they're kind of off to the side. So long as they get one, I think one shining moment and other NCAA stuff.
Yeah, and he's probably going to end up getting an Oscar nomination for supporting actor out of it. Which
do you think?
I just because he's well respected,
and he hasn't got one yet.
Yeah, we'll find out on Tuesday when the Oscars come out. But I don't know. To me, it'll end up being like, do you remember American Gangster, a not especially good gangster movie with Denzel Washington?
You mean there were two films and they only spent about, what, 3 minutes together?
Yeah. But like, Ruby Dee, I think, ended up getting a Best Supporting
yes.
Actress nominated. Literally, it was the same thing. She played the mother. But
she got slapped Denzel, too.
Yes. But, same thing. It was just sort of, she was just sort of there, and she had like the one great speech. It's like, you're going to keep this character around so they can have one great 100-second speech. And then, and it's just, as you often say about supporting characters in movies, like Robert Ori.
Off the bench.
Yeah, comes off the bench, hits a three, sits back down. It's nice, but I do like my supporting characters to actually be there in support, not just showing up, have one speech, and go away.
So, rhythm guitarist, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
You mentioned Ruby Dee. I'm friends with her son, a blues musician named Guy Davis. And when I talked to him right after that, he was like, yeah, she got a nomination for that. Guess who she was practicing on for decades? So thanks, Guy. All right, so that is happening over all that's happening going on around the theaters. I did catch up on a couple of films, one of which, and it happens every year. I think we should actually compile this list. We as critics get screeners, I know, first world problems, and for award consideration. So we get to watch a lot of stuff in advance, and it's kind of one of the perks of the job. But every year it seems like there's always one film they just don't send us that we're like, we keep wondering. And the 2017 winner was Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread, also known as possibly Daniel Day-Lewis's last performance.
Well, yeah, I think it is. I mean,
you think he'll stick to it?
We'll see. I mean, he's, and I say this with kindness, he's been pretty much semi-retired for the last 20 years, making an average of a movie about once every 4 years over the last 20 years. The last one was Lincoln 5 years ago. More power to him if he's in a position artistically and financially where he can only say yes to probably one out of 100 projects that are offered to him. Yeah, but I don't think he would say that if he didn't really mean it. And, you know, I've read the interview where he talks about doing it. He says that making Phantom Thread instilled in him such a profound sadness. And, of course, my line was, well, I saw the movie. Now I understand why.
Yes, you did, snark guy.
Yeah. I guess I'm further down on this movie than I am. Call Me By Your Name, to me, it fell into a lot of movies I saw last year where they were just raved about. And I was like, oh, that's a good movie, not a great movie. Like that, Get Out. I'm trying to think of a few others. You know, we're like, okay, that's a solid movie, but I'm just not in love with it like you guys are. Phantom Thread, I actually had problems with. I found it a very tiresome experience to watch it for the most part, just because once you get past, like, oh, it's Daniel Day-Lewis, he's so good, he's such a technical marvel, the movie is gorgeous to look at,
yes,
the clothes, the settings, it's set in 1950s London. But once you get past that, it ends up being this exploration of two and a half characters that's just not that interesting, because the Daniel Day-Lewis, he's a famous dressmaker, older man, we never get an exact age, but I would guess probably about Daniel Day-Lewis's actual age of 60.
With great hair, by the way.
With great hair. And he, you know, he's in this routine. As you know, he's an emotional renter, not a buyer.
Yes.
That, you know, that he always has a young muse about, who, a young woman who is a combination of muse, assistant, and lover. Not necessarily equal parts.
And punching bag, maybe.
Yeah.
Not verbally.
Yeah.
Sort of. Kind of.
And, you know, at some point, he tires of them, or they tire of her, he tires of her, or she tires of the situation, and they get, and, you know, like, and so as the movie opens, they're getting rid of the old one.
See, I thought they just stuck around, because there's so many women in white smocks.
Yeah.
Well, because they get out.
They work inside this big house where they live in London, and in the morning, all these mostly elderly seamstresses show up.
So he's been doing this a long time.
Is your contention that he's just going through them one by one.
and so this time around, again, I'm going to butcher, Vicky Creeps? Cripes?
It's K-R-I-E-P-S?
Correct.
I don't know.
I can't wait for your pronunciation notes on
I think she's French, if I looked it up properly. And she's much older than I think her character. She's like 34.
I'm sorry, Luxembourg. Careful.
Yes, she's a Luxembourg French.
Yeah, she's almost 35.
Yeah, and I think the character is supposed to be, you know, early 20s. So you got this big age difference between the characters, and he more or less just sort of picks her up. She's a waitress, and they go on a date, and then at the end of the date, he takes her back to his country house where he does measurements on her. And
guys, don't do this at home.
The sister shows up. He has this sister who's sort of like the assistant part, but also running the business side of things.
Played really well by, I have to mention, with Leslie Manville. And they're both the two ladies. I was like, where have I seen them? So you go on IMDb, and it blew my mind. She's the exhausting one in Mike Leigh's Another Year.
Yeah.
She's the one she has the Brenda Blethyn crying disease, where she's just a miserable human being.
Doesn't cry in this movie.
No, not at all.
Very icy, hard.
But she's one of those, that ladies. And she's really, really good. Helena Bonham Carter would probably play this role in about 15 years.
Yeah. We talked about, my main problem with this movie is, I never really understood I can't remember the character's name. It's Alma, I think it is.
Uh-huh.
The young woman character. We see pretty transparently what Reynolds Woodcock, I think is Daniel Day-Lewis's character's name. We pretty transparently see what his motivation, what he sees in her. He sees, you know, someone to pay attention to him. He has this great line. There is this really good line in the movie where he's like, you know, where he says, I don't like to be turned away from.
Yep.
And that's pretty much what's going on. He wants someone to sort of always be there at his beck and call, whether he wants sex, whether he wants attention, whether he wants someone to model for him. We never, for me, figure out what she sees in him. She, you know, as the movie starts out, you know, she is not just some painfully shy wallflower with no intent.
No, and I think
she's smart. She's strong.
Yeah, the fact that she throws him a little attitude as a server in a hotel.
Yes,
that he likes that.
Yeah.
So I guess the other thing is if we find out why, then there's 20 more minutes of the film.
Yeah, and I don't things just don't play for me. It's this very deliberate movie, and you know,
I think all Paul Thomas Anderson films are deliberate.
But I don't know. For me, I never really got inside her head the way I wanted to understand that character of Reynolds.
It reminded me while watching this, if you know Todd Haynes' films, this is a gentleman that takes the kind of 50s melodramas like Far From Home and Mildred Pierce and Carol and takes all of that kind of suppressed social emotion. You know, you're not supposed to display emotion, especially if you're a Caucasian in the 50s. Or a white male, period, as you know, the oppressed. And I think Paul Thomas Anderson kind of taps in, not so much that, but the British dramas of the 50s. Not just the look. I'm with you. It looks great. Daniel Day-Lewis, he does what he does. I'm sure he studied this for months, if not years on end, preparing for this. But there's also little moments, little tense moments. As you watch the film go on, I will say, as an American film audience, don't expect a huge outburst. The outburst that happened in this film, even something as minute as chewing on your toast and buttering your toast and pouring your drinks, distract him and almost ruin the day. I think it's a fascinating drama of manners.
Yeah.
With the weird love story kind of twisted in. And if you saw a post I had yesterday about social media, mushrooms play into it. It's kind of a warped love story. And I think I would expect a warpness from Paul Thomas Anderson. So that part didn't bother me as much, I guess, compared to your experience.
Yeah, the warpness, which, you know, I admit, I don't think by the end of the film, because I was so confused by the female character that, you know, I'm not quite sure what the exact dynamic was. I mean, people have argued that there's a back and forth happening there now where, you know, she's on some level taking care of him and he has decided that he likes being taken care of, even if it's in a very sinister sort of way, which we don't want to reveal much about the movie.
There's also a scene where she wants to surprise him with dinner and she has been told by the sister, don't surprise him. Don't do it. And sure enough, what you expect to happens. I think as well as you kind of thank God this isn't happening in your house.
Yeah, but see, like that to me, that's a great example of a sequence that I know people who like this movie are probably pointing to, and I would also point to it as a disappointing part, just because the absolute worst thing you can do in a movie is to know exactly what's going to happen, how it's going to play out, what emotions are going to be expressed, what people are going to say. I mean, there's nothing I can't. You know, aside from just, you know, like a terrible, terrible movie of like degradation of or torture porn or something like that, there's nothing worse than like, okay, I know what the next 20 minutes are going to play like, and it's just a matter of sitting there, and a phrase I often use in my reviews, waiting for the movie to arrive.
But what if it's done really well?
Yeah.
No, I'm just countering that.
The thing is, once you know the what and the how, the little, you know, shadings and details kind of don't become as important because it's already been ruined for me.
Okay. Also catching up on this last week, your kid and me. But finally, I got to see Paddington 2. So, a little history on this. Back in 2014, I believe, Paddington, we at the IFJA, or at least I know you and I, kind of championed this film because it got dumped unceremoniously
In January,
kind of same time now, and you know, their January films are dumped for a reason. This film, I thought, if they had put it out in the spring, maybe even the summer,
and
it would have gotten a better response.
And absolutely no fanfare. I mean, I didn't read any articles about it. I didn't see any ads for it. They did not screen it for us. It was literally just like, you know, I'm planning to go on the TV show on Friday, so I'm like, what am I going to be talking about? Oh, there's some movie called Paddington coming out on Friday. It must be based on the books.
Yep.
And I went to see it. It was a fabulous, fabulous family film. And so I was really glad that it did end up finding enough of an audience to have a sequel made. Sequel's not quite as good. You know, you've got Sally Hawkins, which I'll watch her in anything.
And by the way, she needs to take a break from water. She's good. She's good. Between this and The Shape of Water, you stay on dry land. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, this one is, we've already introduced the character, and now he's just going to have further adventures.
I do want to say with Paddington, now I will say I enjoyed Paddington. I also enjoyed Paddington 2, But I know I'm in the minority on this. This is why I'm not allowed to pitch stuff at the studios. I adored the Paddington book series as a kid. I adored the short animated films. I had a history lesson, pop culture history lesson with Emma last week, because I remember the early incarnations of Nickelodeon, and there was a show called Pinwheel, which was a series of live action puppetry interaction, as well as these kind of short films, a lot of them imported. So anyway, I've had a long history with Paddington, really enjoyed it. I at times get turned off when you have a children's story like Paddington, like Madeline, where you have to have some form of crime element.
Yeah.
If I remember right, I think there's a heist kidnapping thing with Nicole Kidman, who, by the way, in the first Paddington, who is fun. It's fun to watch her
fun villain, yeah.
Yeah, she's over the top fun, and it was needed. I get it. But I would say there's enough material from the books, and Madeline did this like the first two-thirds, and there was a kidnapping plot in Madeline. But like the last reboot of Winnie the Pooh, You're not putting in pop music, and you're not, you know, there's not a crime or anything like that. If there's enough material, source material, I think an episodic series of these little misadventures with the bear would be just enough for me. But I don't make these films, so
yeah.
That being said, and there's a little bit of it, but the problem in Paddington 2, the crime element is a bigger part of the plot, because Paddington wants to bring his darling aunt to London, and there is a rare book that he wants to save up for, but it is stolen from an aging has-been sort of actor who wants to take the book and finance his own one-man show played without a net by Hugh Grant.
Yeah, he obviously was having a lot of fun
in
this
fun.
Role.
He does not hold back at all. And there's the ridiculous disguises, and he's now, you know, he's comfortable in his skin. He now realizes he's got a five in his age, and he can play these kind of smarmy Lotharians. And every wall in his house are all of his old publicity headshots.
Yes,
going back to the 80s and 90s. Even though it's a longer part of that. And then, of course, we have Paddington in prison, and he has some fun adventures with the chef, the prison cook played by Brendan Gleeson. But, yeah, everybody else is best. Sally Hawkins, Hugh Bonneville, Peter Capaldi. It's a fun little romp. I still would love to have just a thing completely based on the books, but I'm not the core audience.
Yeah, I wish they could have worked more of his adopted family into it. You know, Sally Hawkins and Hugh Bonneville, they kind of just come in and go out pretty quickly. It's mostly him, the prison, Hugh Grant,
yeah.
And the whole family dynamic really gets shunted to the side.
So maybe if they keep it in the neighborhood. And also, we should also mention it's Imelda Staunton is the voice of the aunt. Michael Gambon is the voice of the uncle, who's barely in this.
Barely, yeah.
And of
flashback.
It's a really nice vocal performance from Ben Whishaw as Paddington. So no matter what, I think on Ben Whishaw's when he dies, which will hopefully be decades and decades from now, he will be Q and he will be Paddington. And that's not a bad highlight.
Someone was telling me that another actor actually recorded the voice for Paddington.
It was Samantha Morton.
No, it was a well-known British actor, male actor, and I can't remember who it was now, but supposedly they swapped him out for Ben, or he was slated to do it and then had to drop out.
The first or the second?
The first one.
Wow.
The first one. I can't remember who it was.
I just like that Q and Umbridge are related, bear-wise. And then, what was it? Somebody, one of the IFJA guys wrote, I think it was Evan, that was saying, I think Daniel Day-Lewis would be a great Paddington villain. And I immediately wrote, yeah, but then he'd have to live in a cave for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then I was sternly corrected, Peruvian treehouse.
Yes.
He'd live there for 8 months and figure out how to.
Yeah.
So anyway, but yeah, Emma and I went. She's not listening to the show, so I can tell you. You know, my daughter's 16. Anytime I can shave a few years off of her by going to the movies, and I asked her, I said, would you be embarrassed if you go see Paddington 2? And she's like, no. So we went Thursday night, a lot of folks, 7:30 screening. We got to the theater at 7:25, nobody there.
Yeah.
Not a one. I'm like, oh, well, and that's a fair. Also, it should be noted, a little note, this was originally by the Weinstein Company, and they kind of had to sell it pennies on the dollar to Warner Brothers, I think, so they could.
Was this Thursday this week or Thursday last week?
Last week.
What theater were you at?
It was one near my hometown, near my town.
I was going to say, I also was at the 7 o'clock show on
Thursday
night with my kids, yeah.
Oh, was it well attended?
There were maybe 50 people.
Oh, that's good. So 7:25, nothing. 7:30, the preview start. Here comes mom, grandma, and 3-year-old. And then another couple showed up. So, you know, I was like, I'm sorry, honey, you don't get your private screening of Paddington 2. But we see the 3-year-old, and we've been there. We, as film critics and slash as parents, are like, okay, when do you start taking the kid? Emma was about 4 when I still remember her first film was Racing Stripes. I still love, Chris, you bringing the pram to
oh, yeah.
Rabbit Hole.
Yes.
That does not count, folks. It was,
Yes. Where I had my son, infant, in the stroller, and literally, like, you know that ramp in most modern movie theaters, you have that ramp that goes up the sides of the stadium theater. That's where I was, just going back and forth to get him to calm down so I could just see most of the screen over the lip there.
Did you get sitcom wife look when you told her that you were taking it to this?
No, I'd actually done it a few times, but it obviously was not going to be a long-term solution.
Fair enough. So anyway, we're watching the movie, and about an hour in, off to my left, here comes the 3-year-old down the steps, steps. I'm like, oh, and Emma, we're like, okay, well, we'll see. And then 5 minutes later, you can hear the fussiness, and then it's not letting up. In fact, it's building. And then here's mom with kid over shoulder. Here comes grandma. And Emma and I both looked over and just kind of gave the kid a 2-finger salute. I mean, a proper one, not that one. We're like, nice try, kid. First time out. We've all been there. Hopefully next time he'll be in a better mood and he'll be older. So
yeah, well, I had my 4-year-old with me at Paddington. He did.
He did all right?
He did okay. The previous screening that I took them to, which I can't remember what that was, maybe it was Ferdinand. He got pretty, about halfway through, like, I want to go. And I did not have my wife with me. It was just me. So he had to hang. Professionally, there was urgent reasons.
Bill's character.
Yeah.
I remember Lynn still brings up when the 3 of us went to go see March of the Penguins, and I had to be there. And about a half hour in, Emma got fussy, and Lynn and Emma went to the lobby for the rest of the show. Sorry,
wow.
Lynn. Love you. So, yeah, it happens. So
yeah.
I would just say keep at it. Get them fed. Get them a nap beforehand. What other advice we can do? And kind of like Heat, be prepared to know that you're not getting your money back and you're just going to have to leave.
Yeah.
It's tough. All right. Moving on. Oh, by the way, we were talking earlier about Phantom Thread and Daniel Day-Lewis. Going back through his credits. Now, the only other one I can think where as far as quality work, of course, the famous one is John Cazale. John Cazale is 5 for 5. All 5 films John Cazale was in were nominated for Best Picture. The two Godfathers, The Conversation, The Deer Hunter, and Dog Day Afternoon. So here's Daniel Day-Lewis's film credits. Just film. Gandhi. He's uncredited in Sunday, Bloody Sunday. I'm not counting that. But the first thing he was kind of noticing was Gandhi, The Bounty, 1984. His 1-2, was it a 1-2 punch? Yeah, of My Beautiful Laundrette and A Room with a View. Nanu, okay, that one I don't know. Unbearable Likeness of Being, Stars and Bars, that's 2 I haven't seen. Then here we go, My Left Foot. Emmersville, New Jersey, haven't seen. Last of the Mohicans, Age of Innocence, In the Name of the Father, that's a nomination. The Crucible, The Boxer, Gangs of New York, Abby Singer, which I don't know, Ballad of Jack and Rose, There Will Be Blood, number 2, 9, I Still Like It, shut up, Lincoln, number 3, and Phantom Thread.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
He's obviously been very discriminating in his choices of what projects he takes.
Yep. So, you know.
Up until Phantom Thread.
He got a call from PTA. You don't say no. All right. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point, WFYI.org, hanging out with Chris Lloyd of the Film Yap. Going to DVD and Blu-ray. The big title. I'm sorry. Before we get to that, there's some other items that should be of note as soon as the screen gets up. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, and again, this all depends on when you're listening to the show, but tonight at 7:30 p.m., you have Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, the original Rick Moranis, also apparently knew when to call it a day. So February 9th and 10th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. on those Fridays and Saturdays, Breakfast at Tiffany's. So good chance to see those on the big screen. The Bloomington Pride Film Festival is going to be at the Buskirk Chumley Theater January 25th through the 27th. That's the 16th annual one. Go to bloomingtonpride.org/film. Over at IU Cinema. Oh, if you get a chance to see this, if you're hauling tail down right now, if you're listening on Saturday at 3 o'clock, as a part of the City Lights film series from 1941, High Sierra. Good chance to see that on a big screen. That's cool. At 7 o'clock, Listen Up Philip from 2014. Sunday the 21st, The Beautiful Troublemaker at 1 o'clock, and then the early works of Cheryl Dunye at 6:30 p.m. Monday the 22nd, The Watermelon Woman / Black is Blue at 7 o'clock. Cheryl Dunye will be lecturing on Tuesday the 23rd at 3 p.m., and then the film Portraits of Jason along with Peak Triangles at 7 p.m. As Boas Maneras, or Good Manners, that will be Thursday the 25th and Friday the 26th at 7 p.m. And then Saturday the 27th, interesting, they're not a double bill, but it's two films. 3 o'clock, Patton. 7 o'clock, Attack the Block. Attack the Block is one noted. This was the film that got some folks in the U.S. introduced to John Boyega. This was aliens invade the Earth, and they wind up going to the wrong neighborhood in London to deal with. And the gangbangers and criminals of this said neighborhood decide to take matters in their own hands. Where do you stand on Patton?
The first film? The Last Days of Patton, the made-for-TV movie from 1986.
By the way, speaking of TV movies with George C. Scott, I got, I talked about this on the show a couple times, I got the six-hour Mussolini miniseries that he starred in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
And he stands behind a giant Italian flag.
Yeah. it's a terrific film. I mean, he's great in it. It's a great portrait movie, and I don't say biopic because we don't know how much of this is George C. Scott and the writers and directors and how much is Patton. I think a lot of it's Patton, but it's one of those things where you take someone from history and make them, enshrine them in a pop culture image that will then stand for what that person is for the next generation or so.
I remember my film genre class at Ball State, and the very first film we watched was Patton. And half the class thought he was a patriot, and the other half thought he was a sadist.
Oh, I think he was both.
He was both. So even trying to shoot down a gunner plane with his pistol.
Yeah.
Standing in the middle of the road.
I actually did my classic film column not too long ago about The Last Days of Patton, which is actually not a bad movie. It's very constrained by the made-for-TV movie format and, you know, technological aspects of it. It's directed by the same guy that directed Marty. I can't remember his name.
Okay.
So not a hack.
Keep going.
But it's interesting because there we see the transformation of the character, what happened to Patton after the war, where, you know, he was sort of, you know, the dog that America needed, you know, the attack dog to just be aggressive and, you know, punch through and do what could not be done. And as soon as peacetime came about, he immediately became this embarrassing liability, and like nobody wanted to deal with him. And eventually, you know, like Eisenhower demoted him. And so we kind of see there what, you know, Patton was sort of one of those interesting characters in history where he had his place in history, which basically was in wartime. And when there was not wartime, he kind of became an instant anachronism.
Yep. Delbert Mann, by the way, was the director of that, who did Marty and Separate Tables. Yeah, was it the same year? I'm sorry. The year before that was Mussolini, The Untold Story. Lee Grant plays his wife. His children are played by Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, who winds up marrying Raul Julia. Gabriel Byrne, Robert Downey Jr., and his mistress is played by Virginia Madsen.
Wow.
And it's written by Sterling Siliphant, who gave us Shaft and The French Connection. And you know, tried to show him as a family dad as well as Il Duce. So, and it's 6 hours long.
It'd be interesting thing if those actors of that, you know, age back then could have, you know, what we call television now with all the different streaming things. And, you know, Netflix is spending $8 billion to make movies and comedy specials and stuff. You know, if you take out like the technological hindrances of making stuff for TV, because, you know, they're pretty much all using the same equipment as what the movie folks are.
Right.
It's kind of an interesting question I've been noodling on a lot lately about the future of movies, movie making, movie going. You know, where Netflix is now making, you know, I heard, you know, this like this year they're going to have 2 new movies a week on Netflix.
Jeez.
And they're not
it's
even.
It's like the old studio system.
Yeah, you know, and other people are doing it too. You know, Hulu's making their own stuff. I just watched this Vince Vaughn prison movie called Brawl on Block 99.
Any good?
It
looks like it wants to be a Grindhouse cut type feature.
It's very brutal. But, you know, it's very well made, and Vince Vaughn is very effective at it. The thing is, there's just so much content out there now that falls into the what we would traditionally call a movie, you know, something where it's between like 90 minutes to 2 hours and 15 minutes long. That's, you know,
Chris will tell you it should have been 145.
Yeah, and it's coming out as constantly, and, you know, it's finding its audience, otherwise they wouldn't keep making it. But it's sort of, you know, going past that. You know, the critics as the arbiter of what are the best new movies out, you know, and I've been thinking about, you know, should we start like on the Film App, should we start focusing more and more on Amazon Prime movies and Hulu movies? Because the thing is, they're not showing them in theaters.
Right.
You know, they kind of played the game for 2 or 3 years. They're like, okay, we'll show our movie in theaters for a couple weeks before we put it on our streaming service to qualify for the Oscars. And the Oscars said, screw you, we're not going to give you any nominations. So I think they're at the point now, like, certainly Netflix, I was reading an interview with their top guy. He's just like, yeah, we're just going around movie theaters now.
Or you can do Will Smith's Alien Nation.
Bright, yeah, if you saw that. That was, I could be honest, say, oh, it's terrible. So I'm like, how bad could it be? So then I watched it. It was pretty bad.
Okay, speaking of unique movie experiences, because we try to point that out to you guys, Friday, January 26th at 7 p.m. at the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library, which is, of course, 340 North Senate Avenue. They are showing a film that we gave the runner-up to for animated feature, but it is the hand-painted film Loving Vincent.
Oh, wow.
And it's about the last days of Vincent van Gogh, so there's a little bit of a mystery. I remember, like, I was getting flashbacks of Immortal Beloved, which was Gary Oldman as Beethoven, I think, in his final years.
Yeah.
Somebody's trying to find him. So
it's kind of like a murder mystery. It's animated using actual painted, which I believe we actually even had some local artists that worked on the film.
On paper, it would be, well, it's something Kobe and Bianca, Bianca would want to see, Kobe would not. But I mean, it's this kind of, you know, Downton Abbey-esque costume drama of trying to find Van Gogh's, you know, the puzzle pieces for his last days. But the fact that it is hand-painted, it is visually a marvel. So if you're really into cool-looking stuff, and it's all in the style of Van Gogh as well. You get a chance to see that at the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library next Friday.
And I believe Indiana Film Journalists, did we not give that our original Vision Award for 2017? It was either the winner or the runner-up. I can't remember which.
I will check in just a minute, and I accidentally hit the IFB. I don't know what group that is, and that's not helping either.
Pretenders, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, actually, while I have you, by the way, hot typing action here on Film Sociology. the Film Awards. Here we go. I was like, did we also, did anybody check and see what snarky things were said about our mugshots this year?
Oh, it's out there. It was pretty snarky. Although I should say I read it up until the point our awards came out. I didn't actually read them after our awards came out, so I don't know if how people reacted to that.
Oh, here we go. I'm sorry. Again, now scrolling action here. Loving Vincent was our No, it did win our original Vision Award.
Yeah, I thought it did. So,
and yes, we're also patting ourselves on the back on social media because somebody posted their award online, and that makes us feel warm and fuzzy. That's the director of Columbus.
Yes, Koganada. For our first time, we decided, believe it or not, I've actually been. We've received inquiries from representative of filmmakers in the past saying, is there a physical award?
Now we got to make one.
Yeah, that comes from you guys. Because, you know, like the New York City Critics Group.
Right.
I'm pretty sure they give out, they do an actual ceremony in tuxedos and the whole schmear. We're poor Hoosiers. We can't do an award for every single category.
And we can't do it on Sundays.
But we said, well, let's do one just for the Hoosier Award, because that's, you know, literally the one only we can give out.
Right.
And so for our first physical award, we gave that to the film Columbus. We, of course, then had to, once we got to pass the challenge of actually, you know, getting one designed and manufactured of, well, how do we get it to them? It's not like these people's addresses are on the...
And they won't give us the... Yeah. We also got tweets from Jessica Chastain and Rebecca Hall. We're not getting their addresses.
Yeah, we're not getting their addresses.
Not even close.
Because if they did, we'll probably do inappropriate things.
Maybe. Loving Vincent was our runner-up for Best Animated Feature. So anyway, that is happening there. Also Loving Vincent is out on video this week, as well as, if I remember right, your number one film is finally out on video. How many director's cut visions will there be this one?
Blade Runner 2049. Yeah, I hope not. Which you may or may have not heard me say on this program before is I'm the rare person of I like the original cut of Blade Runner.
With the voiceover.
With the voiceover. I love the voiceover. Gives it that sort of, film noir, you know, 1940s. And the whole point of it, you know, laconic
and the shining
and
footage.
Unnecessary, yes. Yeah. But that's, I think, what makes it, I love that. But so the original Blade Runner is just one of my all-time favorite films. I try not to make a top 10 list, but if I did, it would certainly be in it.
Okay.
And so I was so fearful of them making a sequel to it, especially when I heard that Ridley Scott, who's still around and kicking and making movies, was not going to be directing it.
Putting Christopher Plummer in.
Yeah. So I had such low hopes for this movie, and the fact that it worked so well and was so, I mean, it worked from a narrative standpoint. Like, it's set 30 years down the road of the story, and you're like, yes, everything makes sense of how that world would evolve or devolve in that direction. It makes emotional sense with the characters. Just it was in a false moment in it. Hauntingly gorgeous film. Absolutely the most beautiful film of 2017. There is no argument about it.
It's Roger Deakins, isn't it?
Roger Deakins, who,
man,
I think has been nominated for the Oscar
he's 16 or 17 times without winning. Yeah.
He will definitely get nominated, but boy, I'm sure hoping he finally wins.
Going back to something we were talking about earlier, you didn't mind the pace of this one.
No, not at all.
Okay. All right.
I don't mind deliberate pacing if it's going somewhere. If it feels like it's, as you said, building. Stakes are getting higher. These characters are being, you know, they're going on a journey and changing. You know, you've got to move things. I mean, I found as I've gotten older, I have more patience for deliberate films. Like, film that just barely missed making my top 10 list from last year was A Ghost Story. With Casey Affleck under a sheet for, 105 minutes or whatever it is.
Yep.
Extraordinarily slow, deliberately paced film, but I absolutely adored.
I did as well. Okay, I think there's a part of me that while watching Blade Runner, I'm like, yeah, you could have trimmed 20 minutes off of this, but it's almost hypnotic. And it helps that it's the director of Arrival working on it, and he makes Ridley Scott look like Michael Bay when it comes to pacing. And it was fine, but it was a trip. And I mean that in the kind of slang sense of the word.
Yeah, and some really compelling female characters. You had the woman playing, I can't remember her name, but she plays the holographic wife of the replicant character played by Ryan Gosling.
Yep.
And we get to see, literally, a slave of a slave. And we get to see her grow and become more corporeal and have her own storyline and things going on. That was great. And also, the woman, I can't remember the name of the character, but I think the actress's name is Sylvia Hoeks,
okay.
H-O-E-K-S. plays the assistant of the big evil guy played by Jared Leto. And the performance that she gave was just so arresting because she was scary as all get out.
Yeah.
Really, really frightening and intimidating. And yet she seemed to have this emotional core to her where she was not just a mindless killer, where she seemed to really feel things even as she was doing terrible deeds. And that was just such an amazing character, man.
So, ladies and gentlemen, go rent it because we know not enough of you saw it when it came out.
It wasn't a bomb, but, you know, I think the movie made like $350 million worldwide, which it was a pretty expensive movie, so that was probably considered underperforming, so don't rent it, buy it.
There you go.
There's these things, they're round, they're called Blu-rays and DVDs.
Yeah, we still work on those.
You pay a little bit more money than Redbox, but then you get to actually own a perfect digital copy of the movie forever.
What he said. Also out on video this week is a film, and it was one of those, I rented it with the notion of how bad can it be, because I remember reading write-ups on it. It has something in common with a film that came out last year. Two films that had Martin Scorsese as executive producers. Last year was Free Fall, or was it Free Fire, the Tarantino knockoff film with Armie Hammer, Brie Larson, Charlton Copley, Cillian Murphy, right? It's like nobody asked for I didn't know Pulp Fiction knockoffs were back in vogue. Well, this time around, he's an executive producer on The Snowman, a silly serial killer cop movie sort of set in Norway with major Norwegian actors like Michael Fassbender, J.K. Simmons. I'm snarky, there are others. But it's like the Silence of the Lambs 7 serial killer films, and I didn't know that anybody asked for these either.
Yeah.
This is from the director of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and if you've seen some of the imagery of a snowman's head on a decapitated body or a decapitated body on a snowman's head, and it's trying to give clues to Grizzled Drunken, who also, by the way, has great abs, Michael Fassbender, as a cop who's doing a series of missing people cases that turns out into murder. J.K. Simmons rocking an English accent as a Norwegian billionaire pioneer who may or may not be one of the suspects. I didn't really need the Silence knockoffs back 20 years ago, and I guess they're back in vogue now.
Yeah. So. Serial killer movies are always in vogue.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. We just got a couple minutes. Have you been able to watch anything freely? Because I know you get stuff mailed to you all the time. What did you watch after you were done with the IFJA awards? Do you remember?
I did a bunch of reeling backward classic film columns just because I try to work like a couple or 3 months ahead on those, and when we get into the IFJ, the end of the year, I'm watching so many screeners that I don't really have time to devote those. So I actually had like 4 days away with my family away. Mm-hmm. So I actually knocked out like 3 columns in those 4 days.
And go to the Film Me app for this week. I was really excited, and I wish we had more time to talk about this. But when it comes to not the One Last Job film, but the One Last Shot at Glory, you go with Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah.
This week you talked about Ride the High Country, the first of these films that he wound up doing for at least 15 years.
Yeah, this is really, you know, sort of Peckinpah's first notable film. I don't remember what, like, second, third, fourth it was.
He did a lot of TV, and he did a Western with Brian Keith and Maureen O'Hara, if I remember right. But yeah, this was his first big one. Plus, it had some star billing that had never happened before.
Well, this was actually like a B-movie starring Randolph Scott. If you know Randolph Scott, he was, you know, always sort of a utility actor during the Golden Age. Got a little older, was sort of like a cowboy actor. And then he got cast in a movie when John Wayne had to bow out. And then ended up having this late in life, you know, late 50s, early 60s, a bunch of starring roles playing cowboys. And so this was his final screen appearance in Ride the High Country. And he also starred with Joel McRae, who I think said this was going to be his final screen appearance. I think he ended up doing supporting roles in a couple more movies down the line. But really, for all intents and purposes, the last important movie for both of these guys. And it's just about a couple of old lawmen / you know, they did some bad stuff in their days, and now they're going to do the one last job. They don't set out thinking it's going to be their one last job to carry some gold of the miners back to the bank. And, of course,
there's double crossing and things going on. I don't think it's among Peckinpah's best films.
No.
But I think it's certainly worth seeing.
I think, yeah, if you complain about the violence in Peckinpah films, shut up and watch Ride the High Country.
Yeah.
Because you also have Mariette Hartley, and you also have some of the what wound up becoming one of the regular Peckinpah players, including Warren Oates, yeah. L.Q. Jones.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you want one last shot at glory, Ride the High Country, Major Dundee, The Wild Bunch, Battle of the Cable Hogue, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, Junior Bonner, all of those have that same recurring. And to a certain degree, Convoy, yes, Sam Peckinpah's Smokey and the Bandit. So there.
Yes, yes, which he apparently was blind drunk during the whole movie and someone else actually directed.
Still not a video release officially. I don't care what the one company says. All right, so Chris, appreciate you hanging out. Don't forget, go to thefilmyapp.com for all information and, you know, hang in there.
Yeah, we got lots of fun stuff going on over there all the time.
All right, Soylent Green is people, Zardoz has spoken. Go see a good movie. There's plenty of them out there. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!